A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 3, Side 2. Holy Leibowitz, intercede for us, Brother Francis breathed with the others. After a brief prayer, the choir burst into the Te Deum. After a mass honoring the new saint, it was finished. Escorted by two scarlet-liveried sedarii of the outer palace, the small party of pilgrims passed through a seemingly endless sequence of corridors and antechambers, halting occasionally before the ornate table of some new official who examined credentials and goose-quilled his signature on a licet adire for a sedarius to hand to the next official, whose title grew progressively longer and less pronounceable as the party proceeded. Brother Francis was shivering. Among his fellow pilgrims were two bishops, a man wearing ermine and gold, a clan chief of the forest people, converted but still wearing the panther-skin tunic and panther headgear of his tribal totem, a leather-clad simpleton carrying a hooded peregrine falcon on one wrist, evidently as a gift to the Holy Father, and several women, all of whom seemed to be wives or concubines, as best Francis could judge by their actions, of the converted clan chief of the panther people. Or perhaps they were ex-concubines, put away by canon but not by tribal custom. After climbing the Scala Coelestis, the pilgrims were welcomed by the somberly clad Camaralis Gestor and ushered into the small anteroom of the vast consistorial hall.
The Holy Father will receive them here,
the high-ranking lackey softly informed the sedarius who carried the credentials. He glanced over the pilgrims, rather disapprovingly, Francis thought. He whispered briefly to the sedarius. The sedarius reddened and whispered to the clan chief. The clan chief glowered and removed his fanged and snarling headdress, letting the panther head dangle over his shoulder. There was a brief conference about positions, while his supreme unctuousness, the leading lackey, in tones so soft as to seem reproving, stationed his visiting chess pieces about the room in accordance with some arcane protocol, which only the sedarii seemed to understand. The Pope was not long in arriving. The little man in the white cassock, surrounded by his retinue, strode briskly into the audience room. Brother Francis experienced a sudden dizzy spell. He remembered that Dom Arcos had threatened to flay him alive if he fainted during the audience, and he steeled himself against it. The line of pilgrims knelt. The old man in white gently bade them arise. Brother Francis finally found the courage to focus his eyes. In the basilica, the Pope had been only a radiant spot of white in a sea of color. Gradually, here in the audience room, Brother Francis perceived at closer range that the Pope was not, like the fabled nomads, 9 feet tall. To the monk's surprise, the frail old man, father of princes and kings, bridge-builder of the world, and vicar on earth of Christ, appeared much less ferocious than Dom Arcos, Abbas. The Pope moved slowly along the line of pilgrims, greeting each, embracing one of the bishops, conversing with each in his own dialect or through an interpreter, laughing at the expression of the Monsignor, to whom he transferred the task of carrying the falconer's bird, and addressing the clan leader of the forest people with a peculiar hand gesture and a grunted word of forest dialect, which caused that panther-clad chieftain to glow with a sudden grin of delight. The Pope noticed the dangling panther headgear and paused to replace it on the tribesman's head. The latter's chest bulged with pride. He glared about the room, apparently to catch the eye of his supreme unctuousness, the leading lackey, but that official seemed to have vanished into the woodwork. The Pope drew nearer to Brother Francis.
Ecce Petrus Pontifex. Behold Peter the High Priest, Leo the 21st himself, whom alone God did appoint prince over all countries and kingdoms to root up, pull down, waste, destroy, plant, and build, that he might preserve a faithful people.
And yet in the face of Leo, the monk saw a kindly meekness, which hinted that he was worthy of that title, loftier than any bestowed upon princes and kings, whereby he was called the slaves of God. Francis knelt quickly to kiss, found himself clutching the relic of the saint behind him, as if ashamed to display it. The pontiff's amber eyes compelled him gently. Leo spoke softly in the curial manner, an affectation which he seemed to dislike as burdensome. but which he practiced for custom's sake in speaking to visitors less savage than the panther chief.
Our heart was deeply grieved when we heard of your misfortune, dear son. An account of your journey reached our ears. At our own request you traveled here, but while on your way, you were set upon by robbers. Is that not true?
Yes, Holy Father, but it is really of no importance. I mean, it was important, except...
Francis stammered. The white old man smiled gently.
We know that you brought us a gift, and that it was stolen from you along the way. Be not troubled for that. Your presence is gift enough to us. Long have we cherished the hope of greeting in person the discoverer of Emily Leibowitz's remains. We know, too, of your labors at the Abbey. For the brothers of St. Leibowitz we have always felt a most fervent affection. Without your work, the world's amnesia might well be total. As the Church, Mysticum Christi Corpus, is a body, so has your order served as an organ of memory in that body. We owe much to your holy patron and founder. Future ages may owe him even more. May we hear more of your journey, dear son.
Brother Francis produced the blueprint. The highwayman was kind enough to leave this in my keeping, Holy Father. He mistook it for a copy of the illumination which I was bringing as a gift.
You did not correct his mistake?
Brother Francis blushed.
I'm ashamed to admit, Holy Father. This, then, is the original relic you found in the crypt?
Yes.
The Pope's smile became wry.
So then, the bandit thought your work was the treasure itself.
Ah, even a robber can have a keen eye for art, yes?
Monsignor Aguera told us of the beauty of your commemoration. What a pity that it was stolen.
It was nothing, Holy Father. I only regret that I wasted 15 years.
Wasted? How wasted? If the robber had not been misled by the beauty of your commemoration, he might have taken this, might he not?
Brother Francis admitted the possibility. The 21st Leo took the ancient blueprint in his withered hands and carefully unrolled it. He studied its design for a time in silence. Then,
"Tell us, do you understand the symbols used by Leibowitz? The meaning of the, thing represented?"
"No, Holy Father, my ignorance is complete."
The Pope leaned toward him to whisper,
"So is ours."
He chuckled, pressed his lips to the relic as if kissing an altar stone, then re-rolled it and handed it to an attendant.
"We thank you from the bottom of our heart for those 15 years, beloved son," he added to Brother Francis. "Those years were spent to preserve this original. Never think of them as wasted. Offer them to God. Some day the meaning of the original may be discovered, and may prove important."
The old man blinked, or was it a wink? Francis was almost convinced that the Pope had winked at him.
"We'll have you to thank for that."
The wink, or the blink, seemed to bring the room into clearer focus for the monk. For the first time he noticed a moth hole in the Pope's cassock. The cassock itself was almost threadbare. The carpet in the audience room was worn through in spots. Plaster had fallen from the ceiling in several places. But dignity had overshadowed poverty. Only for a moment after the wink did Brother Francis notice hints of poverty at all. The distraction was transient.
"By you we wish to send our warmest regards to all members of your community, and to your abbot," Leo was saying. "To them, as to you, we wish to extend our apostolic benediction. We shall give you a letter to them announcing the benediction."
He paused, then blinked, or winked, again.
"Quite incidentally, the letter will be safeguarded. We shall affix to it the noli molestare, excommunicating anyone who waylays the bearer."
Brother Francis murmured his thanks for such insurance against highwaymanship. He did not deem it fitting to add that the robber would be unable to read the warning, or understand the penalty.
"I shall do my best to deliver it, Holy Father."
Again Leo leaned close to whisper,
"And to you we shall give a special token of our affection.
Before you leave, see Monsignor Aguera. We would prefer to give it to you by our own hand, but this is not the proper moment. The Monsignor will present it for us. Do with it what you will. Thank you very much indeed, Holy Father. And now, goodbye, beloved son.
The pontiff moved on, speaking to each pilgrim in the line, and when it was over, the solemn benediction. The audience had ended. Monsignor Aguera touched Brother Francis's arm as the pilgrim group passed out the portals. He embraced the monk warmly. The postulator of the saint's cause had aged so greatly that Francis recognized him only with difficulty at close range. But Francis, too, was gray at the temples and had grown wrinkled about the eyes from squinting over the copy table. The Monsignor handed him a package and a letter as they descended the Scala Celestis. Francis glanced at the letter's address and nodded. His own name was written on the package, which bore a diplomatic seal.
For me, Messer?
Yes, a personal token from the Holy Father. Better not open it here. Now, can I do anything for you before you leave New Rome? I'd be glad to show you anything you've missed. Brother Francis thought briefly. There had already been an exhaustive tour.
I would like to see the Basilica just once again, Messer,
he said at last.
Why, of course, but is that all?
Brother Francis paused again. They had fallen behind the other departing pilgrims.
I would like to confess, he added softly.
Nothing easier than that, said Aguera, adding with a chuckle, you're in the right town, you know. Here you can get anything absolved that you're worried about. Is it something deadly enough to require the attention of the Pope? Francis reddened and shook his head.
How about the great penitentiary, then? He'll not only absolve you if you're repentant, but he'll even hit you over the head with a rod in the bargain.
I mean, I was asking you, Messer, the monk stammered.
Me? Why me? I'm nobody fancy. Here you are in a whole town full of red hats, and you want to confess to Malfredo Aguera?
Because you were our patron's advocate, the monk explained.
Oh, I see. Why, of course I'll hear your confession. But I can't absolve you in the name of your patron, you know. It'll have to be the Holy Trinity, as usual. Will that do?
Francis had little to confess, but his heart had long been troubled, at the prompting of Dom Arcos, by the fear that his discovery of the shelter might have hindered the case for the saint. Leibowitz's postulator heard him, counseled him, and absolved him in the basilica, then led him around that ancient church. During the ceremony of canonization and the mass that followed, Brother Francis had noticed only the majestic splendor of the building. Now the aged Monsignor pointed to crumbling masonry, places in need of repair, and the shameful condition of some of the older frescoes. Again he caught a glimpse of a poverty which dignity veiled. The church was not wealthy in this age. At last Francis was free to open the package. The package contained a purse. In the purse were 2 heclos of gold. He glanced at Malfredo Aguera. The Monsignor smiled.
You did say that the robber won the commemoration from you in a wrestling match, didn't you?
Aguera asked.
Yes, Messer. Well then, even if you were forced into it, you made the choice to wrestle him for it yourself, didn't you? You accepted his challenge.
The monk nodded.
Then I don't think you'd be condoning the wrong if you bought it back.
He clapped the monk's shoulder and blessed him. Then it was time to go. The small keeper of the Flame of Knowledge trudged back toward his abbey on foot. There were days and weeks on the trail, but his heart was singing as he approached the robber's outpost. Do with it what you will, Pope Leo had said of the gold. Not only that, the monk had now, in addition to the purse, an answer to the robber's scornful question. He thought of the books in the audience room, waiting there for a reawakening. The robber, however, was not waiting at his outpost, as Francis had hoped. There were recent footprints in the trail at that place, but the prints led cross-trail, and there was no sign of the robber. The sun filtered through the trees to cover the ground with leafy shadows. The forest was not dense, but it offered shade. He sat down beside the trail to wait. An owl hooted at midday from the relative darkness in the depths of some distant arroyo. Buzzards circled in a patch of blue beyond the treetops. It seemed peaceful in the forest that day. As he listened sleepily to the sparrows fluttering in nearby brush, He found himself not greatly concerned about whether the robber came today or tomorrow. So long was his journey that he would not be unhappy to enjoy a day of rest while waiting. He sat watching the buzzards. Occasionally he glanced down the trail that led toward his distant home in the desert. The robber had chosen an excellent location for his lair. From this place one could observe more than a mile of trail in either direction, while remaining unobserved in the thatch of forest. Something moved on the trail in the distance. Brother Francis shielded his eyes and studied the distant movement. There was a sunny area down the road where a brush fire had cleared several acres of land around the trail that led southwest. The trail shimmered under a mirror of heat in the sun-swept region. He could not see clearly because of the shiny reflections, but there was motion in the midst of the heat. There was a wriggling black iota. At times it seemed to wear a head. At times it was completely obscured in the heat glaze, but nevertheless he could determine that it was gradually approaching. Once, when the edge of a cloud brushed at the sun, the heat shimmer subsided for a few seconds. His tired and myopic eyes determined then that the wriggling iota was really a man, but at too great a distance for recognition. He shivered. Something about the iota was too familiar. But no, it couldn't possibly be the same. The monk crossed himself and began telling his rosary beads, while his eyes remained intent on the distant thing in the heat shimmer. While he had been waiting there for the robber, a debate had been in progress, higher on the side of the hill. The debate had been conducted in whispered monosyllables, and had lasted for nearly an hour. Now the debate was ended. Two hoods had conceded to one hood. Together, the Pope's children stole quietly from behind their brush table and crept down the side of the hill. They advanced to within 10 yards of Francis before a pebble rattled. The monk was murmuring the third Ave of the fourth glorious mystery of the Rosary when he happened to look around. The arrow hit him squarely between the eyes.
"Eat, eat, eat,"
the Pope's child cried. On the trail to the southwest, the old wanderer sat down on a log and closed his eyes to rest them against the sun. He fanned himself with a tattered basket hat and munched his spice leaf quid. He had been wandering for a long time. The search seemed endless, but there was always the promise of finding what he sought across the next rise or beyond the bend in the trail. When he had finished fanning himself, he clapped the hat back on his head and scratched at his brushy beard while blinking around at the landscape. There was a patch of unburned forest on the hillside just ahead. It offered welcome shade, but still the wanderer sat there in the sunlight and watched the curious buzzards. They had congregated, and they were swooping rather low over the wooded patch. One bird made bold to descend among the trees, but it quickly flapped into view again, flew under power until it found a rising column of air, then went into gliding ascent. The dark host of scavengers seemed to be expending more than a usual amount of energy at flapping their wings. Usually they soared, conserving strength. Now they thrashed the air above the hillside, as if impatient to land. As long as the buzzards remained interested but reluctant, the wanderer remained the same. There were cougars in these hills. Beyond the peak were things even worse than cougars, and sometimes they prowled afar. The wanderer waited. Finally the buzzards descended among the trees. The wanderer waited 5 minutes more. At last he arose and limped ahead toward the forested patch, dividing his weight between his game leg and his staff. After a while he entered the forested area. The buzzards were busy at the remains of a man. The wanderer chased the birds away with his cudgel and inspected the human remnants. Significant portions were missing. There was an arrow through the skull, protruding at the back of the neck. The old man looked nervously around at the brush. There was no one in sight, but there were plenty of footprints in the vicinity of the trail. It was not safe to stay. Safe or not, the job had to be done. The old wanderer found a place where the earth was soft enough for digging with hands and stick. While he dug, the angry buzzard circled low over the treetops, sometimes darting earthward, but then flapping their way skyward again. For an hour, then two, they fluttered anxiously over the wooded hillside. One bird finally landed. It strutted indignantly about a mound of fresh earth with a rock marker at one end. Disappointed, it took wing again. The flock of dark scavengers abandoned the site and soared high on the rising currents of air while they hungrily watched the land. There was a dead hog beyond the Valley of the Mistborn. The buzzards observed it gaily and glided down for a feast. Later, in a far mountain pass, A cougar licked her chops and left her kill. The buzzard seemed thankful for the chance to finish her meal. The buzzards laid their eggs in season and lovingly fed their young, a dead snake and bits of a feral dog. The younger generation waxed strong, soared high and far on black wings, waiting for the fruitful earth to yield up her bountiful carrion. Sometimes dinner was only a toad. Once it was a messenger from New Rome. Their flight carried them over the Midwestern plains. They were delighted with the bounty of good things which the nomads left lying on the land during their ride over toward the south. The buzzards laid their eggs in season and lovingly fed their young. Earth had nourished them bountifully for centuries. She would nourish them for centuries more. Pickings were good for a while in the region of the Red River, but then out of the carnage a city-state arose. For rising city-states the buzzards had no fondness, although they approved of their eventual fall. They shied away from Texarkana and ranged far over the plain to the west. After the manner of all living things, they replenished the earth many times with their kind. Eventually, it was the year of our Lord, 3174. There were rumors of war. Part 2. Fiat Lux. Chapter 12. Marcus Apollo became certain of war's imminence the moment he overheard Hannigan's third wife tell a serving maid that her favorite courtier had returned with his skin intact from a mission to the tents of Mad Bear's clan. The fact that he had come back alive from the nomad encampment meant that a war was brewing. Purportedly, the emissary's mission had been to tell the plains tribes that the civilized states had entered into the agreement of the Holy Scourge concerning the disputed lands, and would hereafter wreak stern vengeance on the nomadic peoples and bandit groups for any further raiding activities. But no man carried such news to Mad Bear and came back alive. Therefore, Apollo concluded, the ultimatum had not been delivered, and Hannigan's emissary had gone out to the plains with an ulterior purpose, and the purpose was all too clear. Apollo picked his way politely through the small throng of guests, his sharp eyes searching out Brother Claret and trying to attract his glance. Apollo's tall figure, in severe black cassock with a small flash of color at the waist to denote his rank, stood out sharply in contrast to the kaleidoscope whirl of color worn by others in the banquet hall, and he was not long in catching his clerk's eye and nodding him toward the table of refreshments, which was now reduced to a litter of scraps, greasy cups, and a few roast squabs that looked overcooked. Apollo dragged at the dregs of the punch bowl with the ladle, observed a dead roach floating among the spices, and thoughtfully handed the first cup to Brother Claret as the clerk approached.
"Thank you, Messer," said Claret, not noticing the roach. "You wanted to see me?"
"As soon as the reception's over, in my quarters, Sarkal came back alive."
"Oh."
"I've never heard a more ominous oh. I take it you understand the interesting implications?"
"Certainly, Messer. It means the agreement was a fraud on Hannigan's part, and he intends to use it against—"
"Shh. Later." Apollo's eyes signaled the approach of an audience, and the clerk turned to refill his cup from the punch bowl. His interest became suddenly absorbed there, and he did not look at the lean figure in watered silk who strode toward them from the entrance. Apollo smiled formally and bowed to the man. Their hand clasp was brief and noticeably chilly.
"Well, Tantario," said the priest, "your presence surprises me. I thought you shunned such festive gatherings. What could be so special about this one to attract such a distinguished scholar?"
He lifted his brows in mock perplexity.
"You're the attraction, of course," said the newcomer, matching Apollo's sarcasm. "And my only reason for attending."
"I?" He feigned surprise, but the assertion was probably true. The wedding reception of a half-sister was not the sort of thing that would impel Thon Taddeo to bedeck himself in formal finery and leave the cloistered halls of the Collegium.
"As a matter of fact, I've been looking for you all day. They told me you'd be here. Otherwise—"
He looked around the banquet hall and snorted irritably. The snort caught whatever thread of fascination was tying Brother Claret's gaze to the punch bowl, and he turned to bow to the Thon.
"Care for punch, Thon Taddeo?"
he asked, offering a full cup. The scholar accepted it with a nod and drained it. "I wanted to ask you a little more about the Leibowitzian documents we discussed," he said to Marcus Apollo. "I had a letter from a fellow named Kornhoer at the Abbey. He assured me they have writings that date back to the last years of the European-American civilization." If the fact that he himself had assured the scholar of the same thing several months ago was irritating to Apollo, his expression gave no hint of it.
"Yes," he said, "they're quite authentic, I'm told."
"If so, it strikes me as very mysterious that nobody's heard, but never mind that. Kornhoer listed a number of documents and texts they claim to have and described them. If they exist at all, I've got to see them."
"Oh?"
"Yes, if it's a hoax, it should be found out, and if it isn't, the data might well be priceless." The Monsignor frowned.
"I assure you there is no hoax," he said stiffly.
"The letter contained an invitation to visit the Abbey and study the documents. They've evidently heard of me."
"Not necessarily," said Apollo, unable to resist the opportunity. "They aren't particular about who reads their books, so long as he washes his hands and doesn't deface their property."
The scholar glowered. The suggestion that there might exist literate persons who had never heard his name did not please him.
"But there, then," Apollo went on affably. "You have no problem. Accept their invitation. Go to the Abbey. Study their relics. They'll make you welcome."
The scholar huffed irritably at the suggestion. "And travel through the plains at a time when Mad Bear's clan is—" Thon Taddeo broke off abruptly.
"You were saying?" Apollo prompted, his face showing no special alertness, although a vein in his temple began to throb as he stared expectantly at Thon Taddeo.
"Only that it's a long, dangerous trip, and I can't spare 6 months' absence from the Collegium. I wanted to discuss the possibility of sending a well-armed party of the mayor's guardsmen to fetch the documents here for study."
Apollo choked. He felt a childish impulse to kick the scholar in the shins. "I'm afraid," he said politely, "that would be quite impossible. But in any case, the matter is outside my sphere, and I'm afraid I can't be of any help to you."
"Why not?" Thon Taddeo demanded. "Aren't you the Vatican's nuncio to the court of Hannigan?"
"Precisely. I represent New Rome, not the monastic orders. The government of an abbey is in the hands of its abbot."
"But with a little pressure from New Rome—"
The impulse to kick shins surged swiftly. "We'd better discuss it later," Monsignor Apollo said curtly. "This evening, in my study, if you like."
He half-turned and looked back inquiringly, as if to say, "Well?"
"I'll be there," the scholar said sharply, and marched away.
"Why didn't you tell him flatly no then and there?"
Claret fumed when they were alone in the embassy suite an hour later.
"Transport priceless relics through bandit country in these times? It's unthinkable, Messer."
"Certainly."
"Then why—"
"Two reasons. First, Thon Taddeo is Hannigan's kinsman, and influential, too. We have to be courteous to Caesar and his kin, whether we like him or not. Second, he started to say something about the Mad Bear clan, and then broke off. I think he knows what's going to happen. I'm not going to engage in espionage, but if he volunteers any information, there's nothing to prevent our including it in the report you're about to deliver personally to New Rome."
"I?"
The clerk looked shocked.
"To New Rome? But what—"
"Not so loud," said the nuncio, glancing at the door. "I'm going to have to send my estimate of this situation to His Holiness, and quickly. But it's the kind of thing that one doesn't dare put in writing. If Hannigan's people intercepted such a dispatch, you and I would probably be found floating face down in the Red River. If Hannigan's enemies get hold of it, Hannigan would probably feel justified in hanging us publicly as spies. Martyrdom is all very well, but we have a job to do first."
"And I'm to deliver the report orally at the Vatican?"
Brother Claret muttered, apparently not relishing the prospect of crossing hostile country. "It has to be that way. Thon Taddeo may, just possibly may, give us an excuse for your leaving abruptly for St. Leibowitz Abbey, or New Rome, or both. In case there are any suspicions around the court, I'll try to steer it."
"And the substance of the report I'm to deliver, Messer?"
"That Hannigan's ambition to unite the continent under one dynasty isn't so wild a dream as we thought. That the agreement of the Holy Scourge is probably a fraud by Hannigan, and that he means to use it to get both the Empire of Denver
and Laredan Nation into conflict with the Plains Nomads. If Laredan forces are tied up in a running battle with Mad Bear, it wouldn't take much encouragement for the state of Chihuahua to attack Laredo from the south. After all, there's an old enmity there. Hannigan, of course, can then march virtuously to Rio Laredo. With Laredo under his thumb, he can look forward to tackling both Denver and the Mississippi Republic, without worrying about a stab in the back from the south.
Do you think Hannigan can do it, Messer?
Marcus Apollo started to answer, then closed his mouth slowly. He walked to the window and stared out at the sunlit city, a sprawling, disorderly city built mostly of rubble from another age. A city without orderly patterns of streets. It had grown slowly over an ancient ruin, and perhaps someday another city would grow over the ruin of this one.
I don't know, he answered softly. In these times it's hard to condemn any man for wanting to unite this butchered continent, even by such means as... But no, I don't mean that.
He sighed heavily.
In any case, our interests are not the interests of politics. We must forewarn New Rome of what may be coming, because the Church will be affected by it, whatever happens. And forewarned, we may be able to keep out of the squabble.
You really think so?
Of course not, the priest said gently.
Thon Taddeo Fardentrot arrived at Marcus Apollo's study as early in the day as could be construed as evening, and his manner had noticeably changed since the reception. He managed a cordial smile, and there was nervous eagerness in the way he spoke. This fellow, thought Marcus, is after something he wants rather badly, and he's even willing to be polite in order to get it. Perhaps the list of ancient writings supplied by the monks at the Leibowitzian Abbey had impressed the Thon more than he wanted to admit. The nuncio had been prepared for a fencing match, but the scholar's evident excitement made him too easy a victim, and Apollo relaxed his readiness for verbal dueling.
This afternoon there was a meeting of the faculty of the Collegium, said Thon Taddeo as soon as they were seated. We talked about Brother Kornhoer's letter and the list of documents.
He paused as if uncertain of an approach. The gray dusklight from the large arched window on his left made his face seem blanched and intense, and his wide gray eyes searched at the priest as if measuring him and making estimates.
I take it there was skepticism?
The gray eyes fell momentarily and lifted quickly.
Shall I be polite?
Don't bother, Apollo chuckled.
There was skepticism. Incredulity is more nearly the word. My own feeling is that if such papers exist, they are probably forgeries dating back several centuries. I doubt if the present monks at the Abbey are trying to perpetrate a hoax. Naturally, they would believe the documents valid.
Kind of you to absolve them, Apollo said sourly.
I offered to be polite, shall I?
No, go on.
The Thon slid out of his chair and went to sit in the window. He gazed at the fading yellow patches of cloud in the west and pounded softly on the sill while he spoke.
The papers, no matter what we may believe of them, the idea that such documents may still exist intact, that there's even the slightest chance of their existing, is, well, so arousing a thought that we must investigate them immediately.
Very well, said Apollo, a little amused. They invited you, but tell me, what do you find so arousing about the documents?
The scholar shot him a quick glance.
Are you acquainted with my work?
The Monsignor hesitated. He was acquainted with it, but admitting the acquaintance might force him to admit to an awareness that Thon Taddeo's name was being spoken in the same breath with names of natural philosophers dead 1,000 years and more, while the Thon was scarcely in his 30s. The priest was not eager to admit, knowing that this young scientist showed promise of becoming one of those rare outcroppings of human genius that appear only a time or two every century to revolutionize an entire field of thought in one vast sweep. He coughed apologetically.
I must admit that I haven't read a good deal of...
Never mind.
Fardentrot waved off the apology.
Most of it is highly abstract and tedious to the layman. Theories of electrical essence, planetary motion, attracting bodies, matters of that sort. Now, Kornhoer's list mentions such names as Laplace, Maxwell, and Einstein. Do they mean anything to you?
Not much. History mentions them as natural philosophers, doesn't it? From before the collapse of the last civilization.
and I think they're named in one of the pagan hagiologies, aren't they? The scholar nodded. And that's all anyone knows about them, or what they did. Physicists, according to our not-so-reliable historians, responsible for the rapid rise of the European-American culture, they say. Historians list nothing but trivia. I had nearly forgotten them, but Kornhauer's descriptions of the old documents they say they have are descriptions of papers that might well be taken from physical science texts of some kind. It's just impossible.
But you have to make certain.
We have to make certain. Now that it's come up, I wish I had never heard of it.
Why?
Fontadio was peering at something in the street below. He beckoned to the priest. Come here a moment. I'll show you why. Apollo slipped from behind the desk and looked down at the muddy, rutted street beyond the wall that encircled the palace and barracks and buildings of the Collegium, cutting off the mayoral sanctuary from the seething plebeian city. The scholar was pointing at the shadowy figure of a peasant leading a donkey homeward at twilight. The man's feet were wrapped in sackcloth, and the mud had caked about them so that he seemed scarcely able to lift them. But he trudged ahead in one slogging step after another, resting half a second between footfalls. He seemed too weary to scrape off the mud.
He doesn't ride the donkey, Don Taddeo stated, because this morning the donkey was loaded down with corn. It doesn't occur to him that the packs are empty now. What is good enough for the morning is also good enough for the afternoon.
Do you know him?
He passes under my window, too, every morning and evening. Hadn't you noticed him?
1,000 like him.
Look, can you bring yourself to believe that that brute is the lineal descendant of men who supposedly invented machines that flew, who traveled to the moon, harnessed the forces of nature, built machines that could talk and seem to think? Can you believe there were such men?
Apollo was silent.
Look at him, the scholar persisted.
No, but it's too dark now. You can't see the syphilis outbreak on his neck, the way the bridge of his nose is being eaten away. Paresis. But he was undoubtedly a moron to begin with. Illiterate, superstitious, murderous. He diseases his children. For a few coins he would kill them. He will sell them anyway, when they are old enough to be useful. Look at him, and tell me if you see the progeny of a once mighty civilization. What do you see?
The image of Christ, grated the Monsignor, surprised at his own sudden anger. What did you expect me to see?
The scholar huffed impatiently.
The incongruity. Men as you can observe them through any window, and men as historians would have us believe men once were. I can't accept it. How can a great and wise civilization have destroyed itself so completely?
Perhaps, said Apollo, by being materially great and materially wise, and nothing else.
He went to light a tallow lamp, for the twilight was rapidly fading into night. He struck steel and flint until the spark caught, and he blew gently at it in the tinder.
Perhaps, said Thon Taddeo, but I doubt it.
You reject all history, then, as myth?
A flame edged out from the spark.
Not reject, but it must be questioned. Who wrote your histories?
The monastic orders, of course. During the darkest centuries there was no one else to record them.
He transferred flame to wick. There, you have it. And during the time of the antipopes, how many schismatic orders were fabricating their own versions of things, and passing off their versions as the work of earlier men? You can't know, you can't really know. That there was on this continent a more advanced civilization than we have now, that can't be denied. You can look at the rubble and the rotted metal and know it. You can dig under a strip of blown sand and find their broken roadways. But where is there evidence of the kind of machines your historians tell us they had in those days? Where are the remains of self-moving carts, of flying machines?
Beaten into plowshares and hoes.
If they existed.
If you doubt, why bother studying the Leibowitzian documents?
Because a doubt is not a denial. Doubt is a powerful tool, and it should be applied to history.
The nuncio smiled tightly. And what do you want me to do about it, learned Thon?
The scholar leaned forward earnestly.
Write to the abbot of this place. Assure him that the documents will be treated with utmost care, and will be returned after we have completely examined them for authenticity and studied their content.
Whose assurance do you want me to give him, yours or mine?
Hannigan's, yours and mine.
I can give him only yours and Hannigan's. I have no troops of my own.
The scholar reddened.
Tell me, the nuncio added hastily, Why, besides bandits, do you insist you must see them here instead of going to the abbey?
The best reason you can give the abbot is that if the documents are authentic, if we have to examine them at the abbey, a confirmation wouldn't mean much to other secular scholars.
You mean your colleagues might think the monks had tricked you into something?
That might be inferred. But also important, if they're brought here, they can be examined by everyone in the collegium who's qualified to form an opinion. And any visiting thans from other principalities can have a look at them, too. But we can't move the entire collegium to the southwest desert for 6 months.
I see your point.
Will you send the request to the abbey?
Yes.
Than Taddeo appeared surprised.
But it will be your request, not mine. And it's only fair to tell you that I don't think Dom Paolo, the abbot, will say yes.
The than, however, appeared to be satisfied. When he had gone, the nuncio summoned his clerk.
You'll be leaving for New Rome tomorrow, he told him.
By way of Leibowitz Abbey?
Come back by way of it. The report to New Rome is urgent.
Yes, messere.
At the abbey, tell Dom Paolo that Sheba expects Solomon to come to her, bearing gifts. Then you better cover your ears. When he finishes exploding, hurry back so I can tell Than Taddeo no.
Chapter 13. Time seeps slowly on the desert, and there is little change to mark its passage. 2 seasons had passed since Dom Paolo had refused the request from across the plains, but the matter had been settled only a few weeks ago. Or had it been settled at all? Texarkana was obviously unhappy with the results. The abbot paced along the abbey walls at sundown, his jaw thrust ahead like a whiskery old crag against possible breakers out of the sea of events. His thinning hair fluttered in white pennants on the desert wind, and the wind wrapped his habit bandaged tight about his stooped body, making him look like an emaciated Ezekiel with a strangely round little paunch. He thrust his gnarled hands into his sleeves and glowered occasionally across the desert toward the village of Sanli Bowitz in the distance. The red sunlight threw his pacing shadow across the courtyard, and the monks who encountered it in crossing the grounds glanced up wonderingly at the old man. Their ruler had seemed moody of late, and given to strange forebodings. It was whispered that the time soon was coming when a new abbot would be appointed ruler over the brothers of St. Leibowitz. It was whispered that the old man was not well at all. It was whispered that if the abbot heard the whispers, the whisperers should speedily climb over the wall. The abbot had heard, but it pleased him for once not to take note of it. He knew well that the whispers were true. "Read it to me again,"
he said abruptly to the monk who stood motionless near at hand. The monk's hood jogged slightly in the abbot's direction.
"Which one, Domne?"
he asked.
"You know which one." "Yes, my lord."
The monk fumbled in one sleeve. It seemed weighted down with half a bushel of documents and correspondence, but after a moment he found the right one. Affixed to the scroll was the label, Sub immunitate apostolica hoc suppositum est, quisquis nuncium molestare audeat, ipso facto excommunicetur. Detail. Redissimo Domno Paolo de Pecos, Albertian Order of Leibowitz, Abati. Monastery of the Leibowitzian Brethren, environs of Sanli Bowitz Village. Southwest Desert, Empire of Denver. Qui salutem dicit, Marcus Apollo. Papatiae Apocrisarius Texarkanae. This book is continued on Cassette 4, Side 1.